Hello, and welcome to the Movie Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll have a spoiler-filled discussion about a movie we think you'll enjoy. In this episode, I am joined by my sister Kay, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on King Kong from 1933.
The Fay Wray movie.
This is the original Fay Wray, not to be confused with Son of Kong, which amazingly was also released in 1933. That surprised me.
I had no idea. And it's also Fay Wray, etc.
And was she in that one?
I thought it was saying, yeah, it was the same basic cast.
I thought her and the Jack Darrow character were not in it.
Oh, interesting.
I think it was the guy who was in the
It was the producer, director?
The director, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
But not to get ahead of ourselves,
yeah,
although
sorry.
We always do that.
Yeah, we do.
This is one that may seem like an obvious pick, may seem like an odd pick. There have been, obviously, King Kong comic books, so we'll say that was part of it. That's absolutely not why I decided we were going to do this film at this time. This episode's going to go up on June 19th, which is rare for me to know exactly when, particularly a movie one, is going to go up.
2020,
yes. Year 2020. It's going to be our Father's Day episode, essentially. And we'll get to, after we've talked about the movie, the connection to our father and stuff on this. So I was obviously aware of the King Kong film.
Mm-hmm.
How could you be on the planet and not? But I don't know that I'd ever actually seen this one.
I'd never seen this film, but I'd seen images from it.
Certainly clips of Kong swatting away the airplanes. If you've studied film, if you've have seen almost any documentary on the history of film or something like that, it's hard not to come across some King Kong stuff, particularly if you've seen anything about like Ray Harryhausen or other stop motion stuff. But I don't think I'd ever watched the whole thing. I was surprised because we've got the DVD of it here. Surprised that obviously it's a different format aspect ratio, but not only did it not fill the screen, you know, on the width, didn't fill it on the height. They had little letterboxes above and below, which surprised me. And then the, what was it, 4 or 5 minutes of overture at the beginning?
I half expected an intermission since we had an overture.
I was, surprised. It was 147 or so minutes.
Hour 47.
Hour 47. You're correct. Sorry.
104. Which is interesting math.
That's wrong. It's not 100.
Well, the DVD box says 104.
You are correct.
When we played it.
They didn't count the intermission.
The overture. Yes.
The overture. Sorry. There was no intermission. That's why they didn't count that either. But it was funny because this was, again, 1933, different era of filmmaking. They had the credits up front.
Yes.
As you would expect.
Yes.
At the end, it's like we're getting near the end. It's like there's like 30 seconds left. What are they going to do? They basically go to the RKO thing, logo. They flash one slide of credits and boom, they're out.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like a mic drop kind of a thing these days versus, you know, the half hour it seems like some major pictures get.
Mm-hmm.
And this was done stop motion for a lot of it.
Yes.
I think there was the fight between Kong and like the pterodactyl or whatever that IMDb says, you know, it's like 7 weeks of filming. You know, there had to be an army of people involved in all of this.
Well, and that one would have been one of the more complex ones because that was the one where first he had to rescue Fay Wray. Then he had to do the full on fight.
Yeah. Well, and there were quite a few fights between Kong and like the dinosaur, Kong and like the snake water monster kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
We spent a lot more time in the jungle than I was expecting.
Well, and okay, first of all, I commented during the movie that it seems hard to refer to 90 years ago as having good tech and using it well.
They knew what they were doing. This, I mean, there were a couple of places, like when we're on the island looking at the wall, there's the natives up at the top of the wall and stuff, and there was a line you could see almost like a burn edge kind of a thing for the mat, if you were looking for it, which of course I was, because it's like, how did they do this? Where were they using matte painting or matte technology, you know, compositing and stuff like that. But it was surprisingly smooth. And man, some of the places where Kong is like putting down Fay Wray's character and such, it was smooth.
Well, and I was teasing you, it's very fortunate that Fay Wray's character had a tendency to faint.
Yes, she would faint and then Kong would pick her up.
Or put her down.
Or put her down.
But that meant less movement of the character during the pickup and put down, which made that transition easier.
But there were even some times where a miniature person, you know, in the stop motion was flailing about, unbelievably so.
Yeah.
But it's funny because I would say a movie I would compare this to would be Star Wars.
It's funny you say that. That came to mind for me too.
Both were cutting edge visual effects for their time.
Mm-hmm.
I think this one, frankly, holds up better than the original cut of Star Wars. Now, granted, they've updated the effects and stuff. Because there's some places where, like, the TIE fighters and stuff, you can clearly see the matting box around the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here, I would say it was remarkably smooth tech when they do the compositing, when they had the background shots behind the animation.
In some ways, I think this movie benefits from being black and white and not being Blu-ray. Because I think some of the roughness, if you will, to the effects gets lost in that degraded quality, if you will.
Well, it's also a matter of the film because a lot of it near the island is in fog.
True.
To help mask the we don't have a background sort of a thing. And there are other things where because we don't have that fidelity of Christmas, you're right. If this was on, if I'd gotten the Blu-ray version, we might have had a different feeling on this.
Well, and if they had tried, because, you know, there are these stories about they're going back to the old films and they're basically trying to retouch them and make them Blu-ray quality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of the forest scenes here particularly, where the three-dimensionality came from the fact that they had Kong back in the miniatures and then the live-action people in literally a different forest. And they were mixing the two footages.
It's funny because when we got to the scene where they were chasing Kong and they encountered the first dinosaur, I think it was, and they lobbed the bomb at it.
Yes.
I felt the bomb should have gone further back or the depth was off.
Yeah.
But again, they're throwing from live action to stop motion. It's not surprising the depth feels a little off. But that was one of the few places it did.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny you say that. Robbie Amell got sort of forced into an interview sometime within 2020, as I recall even. Some movie he did years ago. Somebody happened to watch it and clipped out the little scene. And in this interview, he's saying, I begged the director, reshoot the scene. Change how we're shooting the scene. This is horrible. And the director said, oh, nobody will notice. It's just you. And here it is. This footage has now come back years later to haunt him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like now a meme on social media. And what it is he was supposed to throw a football like he's a star football player, only he was throwing it to someone 2 feet away.
Oh.
And that person was between the camera operator and the guy holding up the reflectors. So he's trying not to hit the camera or the guy holding up the reflectors, trying not to pummel this poor guy 2 feet away who's supposed to catch it.
Yeah. It's like, how do I look like I'm throwing the thing where if I throw it any distance?
Yeah. And it's like, how do I not injure the person catching it and make it look like a real throw that's going 50 feet?
Well, and when the guy threw the bomb, it looked like he was throwing it and stuff. I thought the dinosaur was further back.
Yeah.
But overall, I mean, the Kong effects were amazingly well done.
Mm-hmm.
The story held up better than I thought it was going to.
Well, and that's why I was asking you early on, because I didn't think there was other source material, and we confirmed there wasn't.
No.
But it has that depth, that richness. I loved the music. You could tell it was written for this movie.
Oh, absolutely. But I was afraid that here is a, what, almost 90-year-old film. Is it going to work for the modern me?
Yes.
Or not? Because there are some older films, it's just I have a hard time sitting through.
Well, and I was sitting here thinking, okay, 1933 was the audience this was made for, going into it with.
Mm.
Okay, so 1929 is the Depression. So the Depression is still effectively happening. We're still in the Depression mindset. So having a girl stealing a piece of fruit, desperate for food, weak from not eating, can't afford a meal, that totally makes sense to this audience.
Yeah.
You know, but also only willing to take a job if the boss doesn't want more than just the legit job.
Right. Right.
That was really well woven in. But the other thing about the captain of the ship wanting to know where they're going and all of that stuff, we're not terribly far out from Shackleton going to the South Pole and not making it and having the Great Wrecks down there, the people trying to find the mythical Northwest Passage and ships going down up there.
I mean, this was not an era where you've got GPS and things of that. It's like, let's look at the charts, we're going to a certain place, you know.
Yeah. And this is a period where people are very aware of ships going down, even on known routes.
Yeah, yeah. So to go without knowing where you're going, not essentially filing a plan, if you will.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was interesting. I was not sure how much of the film was going to be kind of the expedition to get Kong, or if that would just be kind of act one, and then the rest was, you know, he's get him back to New York and show him off, and things go poorly there.
I didn't know enough to know how this movie was getting him back to New York.
We still don't, and I've watched the film. It goes from they've gassed him on the beach, and then, hey, he's going to be up in lights in New York. Cut to, he's up in lights in New York.
But the implication is they took him.
Oh, yeah.
And it seems to me other Kong movies have had kind of the somehow Kong followed her.
I was thinking some of the other ones actually had him, you know, chained up in the hull of the ship and things of that sort, but I am no expert. I'm not sure, honestly, if I've watched any Kong film.
I was going to say, not my genre. I don't think I've watched any from start to finish, but
I've probably watched more of the Donkey Kong cartoon than King Kong, and I haven't watched much of any of the Donkey Kong cartoon.
I will say that I love Beauty and the Beast a bit from start to finish, because from that context, I kept thinking, you know what? If Kong was just some scarred, misunderstood human, if Kong was Tarzan,
yeah,
we'd be viewing him entirely differently.
He had a human aspect to him a number of times.
Well, there was that, but there was also the fact that he saved. Now, he first endangered Annie. No doubt about it. But
certainly saved her a number of times. For me, it was when the natives were spearing him. There was one time he's pulling one out of the back with a come on, guys, sort of a look.
Yes, yes. Well, and there's more than once where he reaches down, he feels the blood on him, and he just kind of looks at it like, why did you hurt me?
Yeah.
Yeah. They did a really good job humanizing him.
There were admittedly a couple of times Kong's face looked kind of goofy. And that was when they would use the big, you know, animatronic or whatever that people were moving, you know, to do the expressions. But when you got to the stop motion, that's where I thought the expressions were better and really well done.
The problem I had was when he was peering in windows, like in the train window.
Some of those, I think, was where they'd used the giant head, where they had three guys kind of doing things. And this was, of course, pre-Muppet technology, so you didn't have that kind of mastery of it by probably like two generations, maybe. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a solid story. It was, to me, a little hokey with the work at the beginning of the, I'm going to tell a film about Beauty and the Beast and stuff. And then at the end, oh, he was killed by Beauty sort of a thing.
Yes, yeah.
To me, a little sappy, a little...
To me, that was very 1930s.
Yeah, it felt forced, but it gave it a book ending, so yeah. It made sense. I was just surprised how far into the film it was before we're back in New York, because we're barely in New York at the beginning.
Yeah.
Just for a couple of scenes. But then also, before we even get a mention of the Empire State Building, we're 6 minutes, 7 minutes from the end, maybe, when he's climbing up there?
Yeah.
I mean, that to me is like the hallmark moments of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And we're you know, winding down, not winding down, but we're near the end.
Well, it's funny because I do, when I think of King Kong, I think of climbing the Empire State Building. Mm-hmm. And not that we've gotten to Dad's connection yet.
I was going to say, we'll get there.
But I will say that one of the things that we had gotten Dad eons ago was maybe at most a foot tall Empire State Building that had King Kong climbing it, that was on top of a bookcase in the living room.
When did we get that for him? Had to be after.
It was, yeah, okay. It was late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, we'll get to the what it was after in a few minutes.
Yeah.
I'm sure somebody out there is thinking, your dad climbed the Empire State Building? No, he didn't. Trust me, but...
Yeah, and he's grateful he didn't. Not even the stairs. But then another 10 or 15 years after that, because, you know, I think King Kong, it connects me to Dad, I had seen a King Kong climbing the Eiffel Tower.
Mm.
when I was in Paris at the airport, and I thought, how funny that it's not just an American and Empire State Building thing. So I had picked that up as a Christmas ornament for Dad.
Oh, that's funny.
And brought it home as a present. And I mean, the moment Dad opened it, he just started laughing because he understood why I'd seen it and thought of him. But I never would have thought of King Kong and the Eiffel Tower.
No, but I can see where somebody would have. Here's an iconic, you know, I could see, I wasn't say the Leaning Tower of Pisa, but other big, you know, iconic buildings like that.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get into why we picked this film and stuff, is there other stuff we want to talk about the film? Again, cutting edge technology holds up story-wise, certainly effects-wise for the time.
The other thing I'll say, though, is going back to your comment about the monster fight, I finally understand why people say, you know, Godzilla versus this and all these monster matchups make sense.
Yeah, the Kong versus whatever. I mean, we had three or four of those bouts in this film.
Yeah, which I never realized or appreciated.
No, I don't think I had either.
Now, what genre do we qualify this as?
I would argue, I almost wanted to say sci-fi, but it's not.
That's what I'm struggling with.
I would say it's Monster of the Week. Kaijus is kind of what I'd put it as, which is the Japanese Godzilla sort of genre, if you will. But really, this is one of those films that probably defined the genre.
Yeah.
I think there are certain films that there may have been ones like it before, but this was the one. No. At this point, it's iconified, and Die Hard, I think, would be a good example of that.
Yeah.
I would argue that to a large degree, while there had obviously been sci-fi films before Star Wars, that particular sub-brand of the genre was created there. Here, I would be hard-pressed to name it as anything other than kind of the giant monster sort of thing. And we've gotten so many, I mean, Rampage, one of the more recent Rock films and stuff like that since then, Mighty Joe Young. There's tons of riffs on it, but, and again, probably half a dozen or a dozen various King Kong or Son of Kong type movies. And again, the fact the sequel was done 9 months later blows me away.
Yeah.
And I'm a little curious about that.
I'm very curious about it because I'm curious how much they were able to capitalize on this to make that.
I'm curious how they could do it in 9 months. We were seeing 7 weeks to do one of these fights. So yeah. I may see if I can hunt it down.
I thought it was released 9 months later.
I can't imagine you would do a sequel at that point in time.
Yeah.
Until you'd seen how this did.
Yeah. And that's my struggling point.
Because I think RKO, this is what saved it from bankruptcy.
Yeah. Now, Fay Wray was the only cast name I recognized.
Yep, same here.
If this were a 2013 film instead of a 1933 film, we'd have had a love triangle, probably.
Absolutely.
You were teasing me we would have had bromance.
Yeah, I think there were a couple of opportunities for that.
I mean, there were just a few things like that that I noticed. I thought it was funny that the cook seemed to be the token foreigner on the ship.
Yeah, and once the crew goes off to rescue her and he offers and they say, no, it's no place for a cook, he's never seen again.
I noticed that.
I think if it was a modern film, either the captain of the ship or the director, somebody would have had ulterior motives.
Yes, definitely.
And would not have been on the up and up.
Well, and honestly, that's part of why several times I asked you, wait, I think that's the director, but are you sure he doesn't have his camera with him? Because he had kept saying, "There, always have the camera with you. There's always an opportunity for footage."
Yeah, there are a couple of lines here and there that I see why they did it, to explain he doesn't have a cameraman, he's going to do this, this is why we take the girl, that kind of stuff. But they didn't always follow through.
Yeah.
But I didn't really expect them to.
True.
This is just one where they had the concept for the film and they put a plot around it.
Yes.
This is not these characters act in the most logical, consistent manner.
Yeah.
Not that they do crazy stuff, but there's a larger-than-life aspect in places to some of these characters.
Yeah.
A little over the top in places. But again, it was surprising to me how well a film from 1933 played for me today in 2020.
Yeah, definitely. It holds up.
So I definitely see why this is a very well-regarded film, and anyone who hasn't seen it, I think, should.
Yeah, I agree.
And honestly, it surprises me it took us this long to watch it.
I'm shocked it took us this long, honestly. I'm surprised. Well, okay, on one hand, I know why we didn't see it in the 80s. We didn't have a VCR in the early 80s.
Yeah, but we'd had one after that, and I would have.
Yeah.
I'm sure Dad had probably thought, oh, we should watch it at some point, and maybe we just didn't take him up on it or something.
Mom wouldn't have watched it. It's not her genre at
all. No, it's absolutely not for mom.
So that's part of that.
She's not into sci-fi, fantasy, monster movies, anything of the sort.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. So shall we explain the connection to this?
Yes.
Okay. We have a connection to it, and I think there's a secondary thing that makes it a little timely in 2020, and we'll get to that at the end, but remind me.
Okay.
But I want to roll back to 1983.
Mm-hmm.
And the, I guess it was a Super 8 movie camera I had at the time. And somewhere in this house, I'm pretty sure I've still got those films.
You know, as I recall, that's the camera you even did stop motion movies with.
Absolutely. My action figures and stuff like that. Some of the Mego ones and stuff.
Yeah.
If I can find those films, we may see what it would take to transfer them into, you know, onto the computer or something.
Yeah, because I remember Dad would, first, the whole family would get together and Dad would have the screen set up and let you show your movies.
Mm-hmm.
But then afterwards, I remember you and Dad would go back and rewatch the movies with Dad saying, you didn't get enough frames of this. That's why it played too fast.
He was very indulgent.
Yeah, he was teaching.
Oh, he was. And, you know, he was, again, gave me the camera, let me use it, got the film developed, stuff like that. This is like a generation before everybody had a camera on their cell phone or digital cameras or whatever. Not everybody had one of these Super 8 cameras. And you could get, 8 minutes of film on the reel?
This was when a lot of people still have 110 cameras instead of 35 millimeter for still pictures.
35 millimeter wasn't even standard at that point. Just to set the stage.
Yeah.
But I had taken that camera with me on a couple of weekends when Dad basically had to work.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, hey, you might enjoy this. Grab the camera. Let's go. And I want to say, was it in Mira Mesa?
Mm.
I'm trying to remember if it was Mira Mesa, Miramar, Kearney Mesa, somewhere in that general area of San Diego where Dad was working. And they were testing some stuff out on the weekend because the parking lot was empty and they needed some space.
I remember being jealous that I was considered too young and I had no excuse to be with him. But because you had the camera, Dad said that you using your camera was an excuse for you to get to mm-hmm. go to work with him.
So let me tell one of the other things before we get to the King Kong specific part of it, because I think it sets the stage. It was a cold air inflatable company. So there was one time where they basically were test inflating a huge, giant six-pack of, I guess, beer or something mm-hmm. like that. But it was basically like a tent, like the size of, you know, a couple of houses or something.
Well, it was big enough that a bunch of horses could go through it pulling a carriage.
For the Clydesdales, I guess it was. You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. I'd forgotten that part. But it was something you could have a little event in and stuff like that. It was, you know, just insane. And I forget what some of the other ones were, but then there was the one that they did multiple tests on, and it was just wild to watch. And it's the one that when they did the PR stunt it was for, Dad was in charge of all the press for that. And that was when they took an inflatable King Kong and put him on the Empire State Building.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere in here, I've got film I took as, I don't know, a 13-year-old, 14-year-old or whatever, of them doing an inflation of the head of the smaller King Kong, of the big King Kong. Does it stand up? Does it not? All this type of stuff. And I remember Dad telling us afterwards, because of course we didn't go on the trip with him and stuff. We were kids at the time and it was a business trip or whatever,
well,
crazy though it may be.
He was in New York for a few weeks.
Yeah. But he would tell us the story of like, yeah, we got there and we thought we'd done all the measurements, all the stuff. It would, you know, will it fit in the elevator? And it would.
They had called ahead and asked someone to measure the elevator so they knew what size to pack the boxes.
That way the boxes could get in there. They could get everything up. They'd be fine. What they had neglected to do was leave room for somebody to be in there to push the button to get it up.
Well, and they had neglected to say, measure the door to the elevator.
Yes, because they wound up, I think, having to cut the inflatable in half, get it up in the two parts and put it back together up there or something crazy.
They had to unpack boxes.
Yeah.
And basically take the unpacked contents, fill the elevators, and then at one point they had filled the elevator so full that they're like, oh wait, somebody can't get in.
Somebody's got to go up and call it from the top floor.
Yeah.
And, you know, then there's the wind factor up there. There was all sorts of minutiae.
There was a day that they thought they'd gotten all of Kong inflated, and as I recall, it was the left arm just deflated and kind of fizzled down.
Well, and I think there was one point even before then where they had like gotten the leg anchored where the arm should be and the arm where the leg should be kind of, you know, crossed or whatever. There's a surprising number of challenges to putting a, what was it, a 50-foot inflatable balloon of King Kong on the actual Empire State Building.
Well, and they were having challenges working for the client, and the client wanted as much attention as possible for the Empire State Building and, you know, public relations. Any attention is good attention as long as they're not saying you suck.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So almost every single night, all of the nighttime talk shows that were based out of New York were covering. Did you see King Kong today? Did you see the arm uninflate? Did you see this?
I would love to have just those clips from Carson and the other shows of the time.
Yeah. I mean, so Dad had thought he might get one mention in one opening monologue, and he was on day after day after day in the opening monologue. And the client was upset that they weren't invited to be a guest on Johnny Carson.
I would think the getting mentioned like that is the best you could or should hope for.
Exactly. Well, and once they did finally get the whole thing inflated, they were only able to keep all of Kong inflated, anchored, and how they wanted him for something like 24 or 48 hours.
I was going to say only a few days, because then the problem they had is it was disrupting traffic.
Mm-hmm.
People were like, oh, what's that up there? So I think what they wound up doing was taking it down and putting it up in Central Park, maybe.
I forget where. And they had had this whole plan that it was going to travel, but they had so many problems with the big King Kong that was the little Kong that traveled and went to zoos.
Because they did two, maybe three sizes of it. One that was, you know, I don't know, 18, 20 feet tall. Another one that's the full 50 or 80 or whatever it had been. I forget the details.
Well, I do want to mention, because I looked it up, Dad got that inflatable mentioned in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Time magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So for a PR guy and what a lot of people would call a publicity stunt.
Well, yeah, they did this for the 50th anniversary of the film.
Yeah.
And it was literally just a PR stunt.
Yeah.
Let's get some attention or whatnot. But it worked, I think, well for the Empire State Building, obviously for the King Kong film.
Mm-hmm.
And for the company that made it.
Yeah.
You know, it got the concept of cold air inflatables out there. And a cold air inflatable is basically something that you're almost like continually pumping air into to keep it inflated.
Anytime you drive by a place and see some big balloon, usually holding a banner across it that says, yes, we're open. There are some there, genies and all kinds of stuff.
Or the tube thing that kind of, you know, waves around and collapses and goes back up. If you put a cap on the top of it, that's essentially what this guy did.
Yeah.
Except, again, it was shaped to either look like a huge six-pack or a football helmet or King Kong.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, it was cool being able to hang with Dad and stuff on those weekends as they're figuring out, does this work? What do we need to do? You know, because there were times like they test it. It's like, yeah, it works, but it's not stable enough, or we got to tweak this, or it doesn't look quite right, or whatever.
Well, I mean, we remember it because Dad was part of it. Dad did it. But people in New York still remember it. People who lived in New York at the time, moved away, 10, 20 years ago. I was talking to someone last year and mentioned it, and they're like, I was in New York in 83. Yeah. I remember that.
Again, if you saw it, you remember it, because how often does that kind of crazy thing happen?
Well, it's amazing how easy it is to Google, because it's so unique.
Yes.
So, and Dad got the cover of one of the advertising trade magazines.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was so successful.
Yeah. No, it was definitely, you know, one of the highlights of that part of his career. I think he's got many other things he'd done over the decades that are made for, a unusual and colorful life in a good way.
Well, and the Empire State Building at the time launched in their gift shop an entire line of I Saw Kong Climb the Empire State Building clothing and everything. So Dad brought home shirts for all of us. And they made the most of it.
Yeah. And overall, I think he enjoyed the experience. I think there were some parts that, you know, like with anything of that sort, probably were a little frustrating. Again, thinking you had it all planned out and then got hit by, you know, physics, door sizes, wind, and, you know, and then got to take it down once you finally get it up for traffic reasons and whatnot. But they worked with it and did it and stuff. So, you know, that was one of the many reasons that King Kong was kind of on the list of, we're going to do Father's Day episodes. Let's put that on the list.
You know, when we were looking at how many King Kong movies have been made, I don't think any of... There was King Kong, Son of Kong, and then a long dry spell, it seemed like, until after the 80s.
Well, they kept re-releasing this one.
True. True. But, I mean, the remakes. They all seem to have been after the balloon.
I would think so. I think that definitely got it back in the public, you know, consciousness.
Yeah.
And whether it revitalized the property or not, it would not surprise me if it did.
Yeah. Well, and we did ask Mom, because somebody was wise enough to suggest the question, if Dad had seen the movie, and she had to think about it, but she said, you know what? Not only do I recall he saw the movie, they arranged a screening of it to time with the balloon being up in New York. I thought, of course, Dad would do that.
Yeah.
I shouldn't have had to think about that. Well, we know Dad liked sci-fi.
Yes.
Definitely.
I just was never sure if working on the project to get the balloon up there changed his feelings towards the movie for or against or anything of the sort. You know what I mean? Because normally when we talked about King Kong, it was about the inflatable, yeah, not the movie.
I came out of Dad's King Kong experience with the feeling he was grateful he didn't live somewhere like downtown New York that was such hustle and bustle.
Oh, yeah. That
wasn't him.
It's funny because it wasn't but a couple of years after that that I was getting towards college age, what do I want to do with my life type stuff. And of course, I was big into comics. Marvel and DC were based in New York. And I'm like, I'd kind of like to go into that. And as I recall, Dad would, whether he literally rolled his eyes or not, he's like, this kid doesn't know what he's talking about kind of a thing. And I forget when it was we did the trip where we spent a day in Manhattan.
89-ish?
Sounds about right. So it would have been during my college years.
Yeah,
when I get out of college, do I really want to move to New York? Let's let the kids see. And yeah.
89, 92, somewhere in there?
I'll be honest. Prior to that day in Manhattan, the concept of Spider-Man web swinging, it's like, I grew up in San Diego, which is a reasonably flat downtown. Not that it's tiny or, you know, 20-story building. I mean, not crazy tall. And we didn't live in downtown.
Yeah.
So to me, when you've got 2-story, 3-story, 4-story buildings, web swinging, guess you do it on the lampposts or something. But then to get to where you have these just crazy skyscrapers everywhere, you know, the concrete jungle aspect of it really kind of sank in. And I'm sure it is an amazing city. I've got, I've had some coworkers who used to live there and stuff. They loved it, whatever. It isn't for me.
Well, in the 90s, I was offered the opportunity to interview for a job in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple weeks before that, someone I know who lives in Manhattan asked if I wanted to come stay with them for the weekend.
Mm.
And I talked to Mom and Dad about it, and Dad's like, go for it. Okay. So I go out and I stay the weekend and I came back and Dad said, how are you feeling about that job interview?
Yep. But more or less the same thing he did to me.
Yeah.
You really think you want to try that? I'm not going to tell you not. I'm going to tell you, try a taste of it.
Yeah.
You know, and for some people it's great, for others, not so much.
Yeah.
But, and trying to think if we hit the Empire State Building that day we were there. I think we did. We went up there. We did.
We did, because that was one of the days.
Oh, yeah.
And this does tell you what a great experience Dad had. As we got there and Dad pulled out his wallet to pay to go to the top of the Empire State Building, Mom said, what happened to your lifetime pass? He said, I threw it away. And Mom said, why? He said, because I didn't think I'd ever want to see it again.
Yeah, that would have been nice to have, just for the hell of it.
Yes, but he was burned out on that place. And I mean, if you had spent a month or more dealing with challenge after challenge after challenge, I can see not wanting to go back somewhere.
Oh, well, yeah, because it was a crazy time.
Yeah.
Just, again, all that publicity, all the challenges and stuff like that. But he did seem to look back on it fondly and appreciate what he and that company had accomplished.
Oh, I remember the dinner where Mom was asking us if somebody called you and asked you to measure an elevator so they could put boxes in it, what would you measure? Because she had clearly just talked to Dad and was not yet to the point of seeing the humor in it. And I mean, over the years, Dad saw the humor in it.
Well, and I've always been, I think, attentive to detail. Some would argue maybe a little hyper attentive to detail. And I don't know if it stems from that era of those sorts of conversations or whatever, or just that I'm the type to think it through. It's like, okay, if I've got to get this up, I'm going to get it in there. How would I put the box, you know, and just play it through to see where is the snag and then how do you resolve it?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of other people, oh, we'll figure it out when we get there.
Yeah.
People work differently. I just tend to be a little more proactive at times.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I do remember them being shocked how strong the wind was that high up.
Strong, how cold it was. I think there was some issues of could the, I think it was vinyl or whatever it was made of, withstand the temperatures. There was, just from a physics and physical point of view, some definite challenges.
Yeah.
So I think that's why nobody's really done it since.
Well, on cruise ships, they used to have this game that was called, I guess, Guess My Line.
Mm.
And so they would ask passengers to show up 10 or 20 minutes before they were going to play the game. And each passenger would write on a card, you know, basically, I don't think people can guess this about me.
Yeah.
And Dad would put, I put King Kong on the Empire State Building. And he said 9 times out of 10, they wouldn't pick him.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, he would ask the cruise director, I'm just curious, why didn't you pick me? And the cruise director would say, I thought it was a joke. Because seriously, who put King Kong on the Empire State Building?
Yeah. It's kind of, this can't be true. Somebody's just making it up that we got to go with something real.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were a couple of other things Dad did in his life that it's like, no, really, seriously. No, he did. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Well, Mom and Dad went on a princess cruise at one point, and they called me from one of the ports, and they said, you know, we were having dinner at the captain's table, and at the end, we asked for an autograph for you from the captain. Hope you don't mind. We'll bring it to you next time we see you. And the next time I saw them, they gave me a menu autographed by Gavin McLeod.
Who played the captain on the Love Boat.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because that was Dad's sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out they'd had dinner several times with Gavin McLeod and his wife.
I think they also had it with a couple of, on other travels and stuff with some other famous people and stuff. And
yeah, well, Jonathan Winters was on a cruise with them, and they had ended up eating with him several times. At one point, they were at some party, and Jonathan Ware said, Jack, come over here for a second. Dad comes over, and he says, so, I've been getting really frustrated, and I think you'll understand if I put it this way. He says, okay. People have been coming up to me and saying, Jonathan, say something funny. So I gotta say this. Jack, say something Navy.
Yeah.
And of course, everybody around them just busted up. And
mm-hmm.
Dad's like, you know, when Jonathan Wares knows you well enough to say something to the Navy, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. So the other reason I thought this would be a timely film to do King Kong in 2020.
Yes.
And this is a few steps away, but it fits my sense of humor. As I think many people have become aware, 2020, not the best of years.
The year of Godzilla at this rate?
Just about. It's, you know, we had the wildfires in Australia. People were thinking, wow, it's going to be a defining thing of the year. And it's like, that seems like a really long time ago.
Yeah, it does.
The pandemic, murder hornets, civil unrest. I mean, just one thing after another after another. And it was a few months ago, I think after we'd gotten together for one of our Wednesday or Friday night watching of TV, you'd left, and I was still sitting down here, had the projector still on, and I'm like, oh, I'll watch some stuff on YouTube, you know, too lazy to get up, and hadn't found anything on the channels I subscribed to, went through the trending, and there's I spent an evening in a doomsday bunker or whatever. Okay, I'm curious, look cool, whatever. It finished, wasn't a particularly great film, but then the next one, at the end, it's here's some related videos.
Oh no, I know where you're going.
And I clicked on another one, and it was another doomsday bunker.
Only I think it's run by someone I'm friended with on LinkedIn.
Could be. I get about halfway through, and they're talking to the CEO of one of these companies. Started with a V. I forget what it was.
Vecino.
Well, Vecino was the name, but the company name was like Vigos or something like that, maybe. But it stops on the thing. It's, here's Robert Vecino, head of this company. I'm like, Robert Vecino. What are the odds?
Yep, that's him.
He was the guy who ran the company, Robert Keith and Company, that made the King Kong inflatable. Mm-hmm. And he got out of that business in the 80s, got into survival shelters. I mean, high-end, nice ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we might want to look him up just in case. Really? I'm just saying.
Yep.
And there's something about 2020 that makes me think, you know, I can see why somebody would want one of these bunkers these days.
Yeah, the secret or the key to his bunkers is that he's been looking for places like Stargate SG-1 Mountain.
Cheyenne Mountain.
Where the natural rock is so strong, but they've got a cavern system.
Yeah, watching the video on how they build these things, and some of these are high-end places and stuff. Mm-hmm. He had just, for whatever reason, gotten in his head if that's what he wanted to do and needed to do. So I just found that connection
really funny.
Hilarious, given that it's like, okay, you know, dad worked for this guy. This guy is now building shelters. This is a year where, you know, those shelters sure look appealing. You know, I mean, if things get much worse, we need to hunt the guy down. And hey, you remember my dad, Jack Mayo?
Yeah, really.
But I thought that was a funny connection, because I think dad was pretty, I don't know if he was convinced, but he was really curious if the guy who'd been doing the voice for Jack in a Box on the commercials was Vecino.
Yeah.
And I was young enough at the time, I don't really remember his voice firsthand, but I certainly can picture the voice on the Jack in a Box commercials, which was done in the San Diego area. At least that's where there's one of them where Jack in a Box gets pulled over and hands the cop his license. And if you freeze frame on it, the address they use is the Food Maker headquarters in Kearney Mesa.
Yeah.
Which was actually, I think, kind of halfway between where I used to work at one company and where you used to work at one company. It was just funny.
Yeah. Well, and there's at least one commercial that they used to have where we recognized some of the buildings from that area.
Yeah. So, again, that connection anchored it to, you know, what movie do we do this year?
Yeah.
So, when we've got one or two others picked for future years and stuff, maybe we'll veer a little off and do some other stuff. There's a TV episode or two that I think would be fun to do at the right year, and I'm not sure which year that would be.
If you're thinking the show, I'm thinking even if we can't find the right episodes.
Oh, I have the right episodes.
Oh.
I've got, I'm not thinking the one you're thinking of. I'm thinking of The Field Trip.
Oh, okay.
That one, I'm positive I have those. I have to hunt down the episodes you're thinking of.
Yeah.
But we'll need to find, you know, what year just it strikes the fancy to go do.
Mm-hmm.
But I've already picked up another film that did some connection to. And I think I've got another one on order coming and stuff. I figured while I'm thinking about what they are. Because some of it, it's hard to remember which films did he have connections to. What were they? Why? Stuff like that.
Well, and some of them I know he worked on, but it was more he told me he worked on and roughly in what capacity, but he didn't give me his stories.
Yeah, there are a couple where I think you do better on remembering some of the stories, even about the King Kong and some of that stuff, than I do.
Well, part of it with King Kong is Dad had a framed picture from Kong that I think Vecino, in fact, was the one who had written on it in his office right up to the end. So occasionally he and I would talk about the Kong stuff.
Well, again, you living with him and so forth gives you a leg up on that.
Yeah. Two of the movies I recall very clearly that he worked on, because there was a point when I got my driver's license and afterwards that I would occasionally tell Dad, I want to go to LA and either I want to see TV shows filmed or I found out where there are stores, they're selling scripts.
Mm.
And because I knew what I wanted to do in college or while I was in college / after college, I wanted to get them to be learning more about the writing and everything. So sometimes Dad would go with me. Sometimes Dad would let me, he'd say, okay, I'll give you the gas money and you and a friend, I feel okay, you'll be safe in downtown LA with, can go, etc. But he would give me a list of, if you see these scripts, I'll pay you back.
Oh, that's funny. I hadn't realized that.
Yeah. So he had me pick up two specific scripts for him, which is why I know he worked on those two specific movies.
At some point, it would be fun to go to LA specifically for that sort of shopping. My interest is less in the script than the series Bibles and Writer's Guides.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd love to get that for like Stargate and a couple of other things.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one of the nice things about living in Southern California, of being in arm's reach of LA for that kind of stuff.
Well, it was amazing the stuff I learned from seeing actual scripts and stuff. And after I did my time working in productions and stuff, I put together a box that could hold a ream of paper, basically, with several scripts that I had more than one copy of, with some call sheets, with some sides, basically with everything I could think of that was the different kinds of things you get on a set.
Yeah.
And I took them to my alma mater and I gave them to the dean of the department. And I said, look, when I was here, You never showed us an actual script.
Yep, here's stuff that you can give to the students, show to the students, and give them context.
You know, you never told us about call sheets, much less showed us a call sheet. You never showed us sides and just, yeah. You know, all the different things. You never showed us that they were going to give us a map with directions to the next day's set and explain these are the signs you look for to get to parking. You didn't even talk about the difference between base camp and set and transpo between.
Well, and I'm enough of a process junkie that those sorts of things interest me just from a logistics of how do you make this work?
It's a combination of that and your first day on the job, the more you know.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, my very first day as an intern on my very first production, and I wish I could think of the actor's name because he was amazing. This would have been in 95, and he had been working steadily since the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was in The Virginian, you name it. He was in it. And at the end of the day, they only had... That was the last day of that episode.
Okay.
All right, so they didn't have anything more filmed, but he came over to me while he was waiting for transpo, and he said, I haven't seen you previously on the shoot. I said, this is my first day. And he said, no, really. You just get back from some time off, or this is my first day. And he said, you fooled me. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, I had no idea this was your first day on production, and I wanted you to know you did really well.
Nice.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought that was very thoughtful of him to put me at ease like that. And honestly, that was probably the only positive feedback I got that day because everybody else was so busy.
Fooled him, not everyone else.
Well, but he took the time where everyone was so busy trying to wrap for the day and get home because we just worked a 16-hour day and they had to be back at work at 7 a.m. the next morning.
Yeah.
Whereas he just wrapped an episode.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
You know, but yeah. The more you know going in, the easier it is.
Well, and I think our parents definitely tried to get us to think things through, go into situations prepared, and not just kind of wing it and coast through life or something.
Yeah.
And I'll admit there are sometimes I definitely go in prepared. I've got a game plan. There are other times, as many of my co-hosts will attest, yeah, I got no plan. We're just going to wing it. You know, it happens. And for some things, I think you need to have a game plan going in.
Mm-hmm.
I think, like, again, what am I going to be doing, you know, a week from now, 2 weeks from now, I'm releasing episodes and stuff like that. There are other times of what exactly are we going to say about this film, about this comic, about that these sales numbers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You're better off almost having ideas, but not an agenda and a we must talk like this.
Well, I think part of the success of the podcast is the unscripted conversations.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to me, it's one of the fun parts, but also one of the challenges. Again, tonight, we knew we were going to record on King Kong. We watched it. We looked at the IMDb page. We clicked record.
Yeah.
That was the extent of the preparation.
Yeah.
And some of that was just to make sure we knew. I was confused on the year the movie came out, to be honest.
Yeah. No, I knew it was 33 because I knew Dad did his work on the 50th anniversary.
Yeah. For some reason, I had thought I'd seen 31 at one point and 38 at another point. So I had just gotten confused.
Well, and I'm wondering, since 38 was the release date, and it was very early 38, and it took 55 weeks to make.
It was 33 was the release date, but I think 38 was a re-release or something, maybe.
But I'm wondering if 31 was when they began filming.
I don't know where I saw 31. I may have just imagined that.
So, well, if you back up 55 weeks.
Yeah, no, I could, it was...
It was April 33, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was April 33. It still put it in 32.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But again, glad we watched the film. Definitely, we've got a lot of memories around King Kong, the property, not so much the movie, although it's a good film, and just kind of the impact it had to some degree on our lives as, mm-hmm. as kids.
Well, and I will say that, and maybe it's partially thanks to the censorship board of the 30s, but I mean, by today's standards, I think it's family friendly. I mean, yes, there's some blood,
but... The shot or two you're referencing, they actually had a comment about if it had been done a year later, probably would not have been able to do one or two of those shots.
I'm thinking one or two were slightly revealing, but not bad, but I was also thinking in terms of the gore.
I didn't think it had gore. It had some, okay, he's eating people, that's not cool, but it's not like it was close-ups with blood spurting.
Yeah, exactly.
The goriest part was actually when he snapped the jaw of the dinosaur.
Yeah.
That was a little surprising to me.
There were one or two times when I actually called out, Kong, don't play with your food.
Yeah, there was a time he'd kill the thing and then flap the jaw or something. It's like, dude.
Yeah.
Not cool.
This is another reminder why the listeners are grateful they don't watch with me.
Yes. It is one of those things, but you got to think about it. For them to have done that took them part of an, like, maybe a full afternoon to shoot. This wasn't a, hey, wouldn't it be funny if?
Yes.
Or if it was, there's somebody who's like 20 hours later, yeah, hilarious.
Yes.
So I would love to see a, I was going to say a behind the scenes of this, but I would almost like to see a modern, I don't want to say documentary, but, or reenactment, you know what I mean though.
I wonder if Harryhausen's ever talked about it though, because.
Not so much talking about it, but to see somebody film a period piece, you know, as if it were not a documentary, but the production of.
A docudrama.
Docudrama, yeah.
Yeah. Well, because the Son of Kong page was saying Harryhausen was a protege of the effects guy here. And I had asked you early on if we thought Harryhausen was at the very least inspired by this, because the stop action was making me think.
Oh,
stop
he
motion.
Had to be. Yeah. Harryhausen was a master of stop action and stuff. And this is one of the early, you know, quintessential works of it.
Yeah.
So, and from what we're reading on the Son of Kong IMDb page, he had questions about it that he never got answered because it was a very traumatic point in the guy who'd been doing that stop action at the time, his life.
Yeah.
But I would love to see, again, like a docudrama or whatever of just the making of, no, we're going to tell a film about this. You know, and again, how would you go about making the model, getting the model to work, you know?
Yeah, there's a film, it's called like RKO, and then it's got some numbers, but it's kind of a, somebody made a dramedy about RKO making radio shows.
Mm.
That was actually a surprisingly good, funny film.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, you might enjoy watching that one. Because again, it's a different period of entertainment. It's a different mindset for how they were creating entertainment.
Well, and I may see if I can hunt down The Son of Kong.
Yeah, I'm curious about it.
Because I don't know if it was like the first of sequels, but it was, I mean, 1933... I don't know how many sequels they'd done by then. And the fact that it was like 9 months later.
Well, you figure this was 6 years after we got the jazz singer and talking films. This was one of the first orchestra films and big soundtracks. And as I said earlier, the soundtrack was clearly made for the film.
Oh, absolutely.
And there was one point when I actually commented out loud to you, I'd forgotten how much I loved movies where the music is keyed to the scenes.
Yes.
The drums beat with the guy's steps forward, and the music is just enhancing every action in that respect, as opposed to, it's a fight scene, let's do opera.
Well, and the fact that, again, 88-ish years, or however, 87 years later, the effects hold up.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, would you have gotten better stuff with current CGI and stuff? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Probably. But with what they were doing, with how they were doing it, with the time frame they were doing it in, the quality of film, can you keep the I don't know, the remastering or whatever of the film afterwards and stuff?
I was going to say, yeah, the archive, what it takes to archive a film from 33 to now.
Yeah.
And yeah.
All of those challenges and stuff, it was a really good viewing experience.
Yeah, I agree.
Anything else?
I think that does it.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.